Part 13, BOAC.
Now fully qualified, I was based at Herne, the long-haul base for BOAC, and flew Lancastrians. They were basically a Lancaster bomber with the bomb bay taken out and a cabin consisting of a long settee along one side with bunks which pulled down from above. Capacity was 6 at night or 9 by day. Pretty crude and not very comfortable. And the steward's gallery just in front of the main spar meant a step of about 18 inches for the stewards when taking food to the passengers. My other aeroplane was the York, similar to the Lancaster, but with a slightly bulkier fuselage, with space for more seats, 20 if I recall, and a little more comfortable than the Lancastrian. The Lancastrian was fast by civil standards, had quite a long range, and the main trip we did on it was to Australia. At that time, we used to stop overnight with passengers because we didn't fly at night. Even so, you could get to Sydney in 2.5 days. That seems a long time compared with flight times now, but in those days it was quite incredible. These trips used to be shared with Qantas, the Australian airline. We operated as far as Singapore, and they operated from there to Sydney. At one stage, they were very short of navigators. So we navigators used to go straight through with the Australian crew. My first experience of Australia was landing at Darwin, a very much one-horse town, rather like a western town. In fact, the pretty basic hotel we stayed in had a hitching rail outside for the horses. It was reasonably comfortable, but I do remember one of our passengers checking in, asking the receptionist for an early morning cup of tea. She said she'd see what she could do about that, and a few minutes later came back with an alarm clock and a flask of tea. Not quite what he was expecting, but indicative of the level of service at that hotel.
One night we went to the local cinema, a pretty ramshackle place. At one stage, a lot of the locals didn't like the film being shown and started throwing beer cans at the screen. In fact, drinking seemed to be the main pastime there, and they reckon that between Darwin and the next town further south, there was a pile of empty beer cans on either side of the road, thrown down by people as they dropped them. My first trip to Sydney was around about August, their winter. I woke up one morning to see it snowing. Well, a few flakes anyway. And I thought, this seems funny. This is Sydney. Surely they don't get snow. Although there was not enough snow to settle, the next day the newspaper had the whole front page devoted to the event, with a huge picture of a snowflake. Most inhabitants of Sydney had never seen snow. Here is an example of a trip out to Calcutta. And you must remember that aeroplanes in those days were a lot slower, averaging around 200 miles an hour compared with the modern 500, and with much shortened range. Leaving London, the first thing we navigators had to do was get the weather forecasts, with the predicted winds for the sector we would be flying, then make out our flight plan. There were no computers, not even calculators, so making out the flight plan was a case of pure maths. We only had to work out how long it took to get to the various points and courses to fly, but also to calculate the amount of fuel required for the journey. The initial sector would be London to Rome, which in those days took 7 or 8 hours compared with the 2 that it does now, so that was quite a trip in itself. Then we would go on to Cairo, which was another 6 or 7 hours. Then we'd hand over to another crew and have a couple of days off. Cairo in those days was, and probably still is, an absolutely chaotic city. Everybody tearing around like headless chickens. Nobody seemed to know what was going on, and that included the airport, which seemed the most disorganised airport one could imagine.
We'd have a couple of days there, with not much to do, but we were invited to use the Gezireh Sporting Club, the old British club on the River Nile, which is very pleasant and still exists. There you could have reasonably priced meals and drinks and sit by the Nile watching the boats go by. On later trips out, we actually got out of the city to see things like the pyramids and the Sphinx. We did one trip to the pyramids, when we actually went up inside the big one and saw where the burial chambers right inside were, which was all right, as long as you didn't suffer from claustrophobia. From Cairo, we went to Basra, across the Arabian Desert, where there weren't a lot in the way of radio or navigational aids of any sort, so we navigators had to work pretty hard. Then we'd maybe stop off in Basra for a couple of days, depending on the frequency of the service. After a stopover in Basra, we then go on to Karachi, where BOAC had its own rest house, as they called it, which was basic but quite pleasant, and the food was reasonable. As the rest house was up near the airport itself, we didn't easily get into town, but when on later occasions I did, the company had a sailing boat at Karachi Harbour, which we could use, and which we would sometimes go down to the boat. It had a local crew who would take us out somewhere. We could do a bit of fishing, hanging fishing lines off the side of the boat, and sometimes we get good catches, others we didn't, depending on whether the skipper knew where the fish were. The last sector was Karachi to Calcutta, where we used to stay in the Great Eastern Hotel. My first impression of Calcutta was that it was a pretty busy, smelly and filthy city, mainly because the trip from the airport called Dum Dum into town went through some of the worst slum areas, and it followed what I would describe as either a canal or a monsoon drain. Anyway, a big ditch full of God knows what, and which used to stink to high heaven. Therefore, even though it was pretty hot outside, we used to keep the windows closed for that part of the journey. Calcutta, as far as I was concerned, was not a particularly attractive place to stay, so the sooner we got away from it, the better.
One thing I always remember about Calcutta, or at least the Great Eastern Hotel, was that they did have air conditioning units in each room. They were huge great boxes which took up half the window space, and somehow or other they never seemed to be consistent, so they would suddenly speed up in the middle of the night, making a terrible racket. Other times it'd be so quiet you wouldn't hear it running. Another thing that amused us was that staff who looked after the rooms, called bearers, whom we would see during the day tidying the rooms, making beds, etc., would come knocking at the door as we were about to leave. One person would say he had been our bearer, and could we give them a tip for services rendered? So we'd give him a tip and shut the door, and there'd be another knock on the door, and there was another bearer asking for a tip, stating he was the night bearer. This would continue with about three or four in total claiming tips. So that was Calcutta. On the way back, we'd take roughly the same route as we had on the way out. Any transit stops were just for refuelling, and we normally only had about 45 minutes to an hour on the ground. We navigators once again had to work out a flight plan for the next sector, calculate how much fuel to put on board, and file a flight plan with air traffic control so they would know where we were going. We were based at Herne, and most of the crews had either moved down to the Bournemouth area or were in digs there. Life for me was very easy as far as trips were concerned, because we and our baggage were picked up from our door and driven to the airport. We literally didn't see our baggage again until we arrived at our first stop, which was essentially first-class travel.
Back to the home front. After we got married, we had to find somewhere to live. At the time, house prices were fairly high. Mind you, it sounds like a joke now when I tell you that the average price for a house was probably around £3,000. But when you consider that I was only getting about £8 a week, it puts it all in a different perspective. At that time, mortgages were not easy to get. And when you could get one, they usually expected a deposit of at least 20%. So initially, we had a bit of a problem. However, my mum came up trumps as she decided to turn our house in Chigwell Road into two flats. She was going to live upstairs and we would live downstairs. It wasn't a big conversion, just a case of putting in a bathroom downstairs instead of the coal hole and the kitchen upstairs for her. So that's how we started off married life. Doreen didn't find life with me too happy to start with, because I was away for 2 to 3 weeks at a time on average, and then probably home for about a week. Having no one else in the house to talk to, she got a bit bored and tired while I was away. This was unfortunate, but just something we had to get used to. However, there was one advantage of this sort of life as far as Doreen was concerned. When I was home, we had a spell of a week to 10 days free time, so we could go out during the week, whilst others had to wait until the weekend. We were in Chigwell Road for a couple of years, still keeping our eyes open for a property, and eventually my dad found a bungalow out at Kinson, which wasn't the ideal area, but at least the prices were a bit lower. We ended up buying a bungalow in Middle Road for the princely sum of £2,400, and that kept us going for the next 3 to 4 years at least.
I flew Yorks as well as Lancastrians on Far East routes out to Tokyo, India and East and West Africa, and that was quite an experience. We used to carry racehorses occasionally. The racehorses were parked in stalls along the plane facing across the fuselage. The front one was near the flight deck, right next to my navigator's position. We used to carry all our maps and books in a big green linen bag, and when we came back from a briefing, we found that one horse had got his nose into my green bag, thinking it was something he could eat. Fortunately, he hadn't eaten anything vital like the maps, but it was quite an amusing experience. During this time, the Yorks were still operating most of the other routes, and there was a funny episode when we just brought a York in from the UK to Lida, the airport for Tel Aviv in Israel, or Palestine as it was in those days. As usual, after we got off the aircraft and debriefed, we went into the restaurant there and had a meal and a beer. From there, we had a good view of the airfield, and we saw that this aircraft of ours was taxiing out. And when it got to the end of the runway, it did its usual run-up. In those days, you had to run the engine up before taking off to make sure everything was working all right. Suddenly, in the middle of the run-up, this York just collapsed onto the ground. We found out afterwards that what happened was that in the roof of this flight deck, there were two sets of handles, one set for the undercarriage, the other for supercharging the engines. These should have been used in the run-up checks. Instead, the first officer pulled the wrong levers, and the undercarriage had collapsed, dumping the plane on the runway. We were amused to find afterwards that registration letters of the airplane were AGOD, so in this case, a god had gone on his knees.